Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580. Well, there's nothing like me dedicating a segment to all of you out there who are leaders. And trust me, that cuts a pretty wide swath, because any of us who influence others really are in a leadership role, although some of you might carry a heavier title, bigger budgets, and more responsibility than others. I thought today I would spend some time reacting, actually, to really a very nice article that was posted by a prominent Harvard Business School professor who actually I've followed for almost 35 years. Her name is Dr. Rosabeth Kanter. She's at the Harvard Business School, has written countless books. The one that impacted me the most when I was a young kid from a professional standpoint was a book called Men and Women, the Corporation. But I've followed her journey in particular for search and assisting companies all in the area of change. And her article was called 10 Reasons People Resist Change. And a guy that's certainly an interesting and important side of the picture to look at. You know me, I'd rather us look at, so how can we flip the coin? And she does some of that in her article about how people then can, will, and willingly embrace change. Because quite honestly, for those of you who are leaders, guess what? That is your job, to lead it, to ignite it, to embrace it, and in some instances, certainly to have to endure change. But, you know, there always comes that beginning point at some point where you have to be faced with how do you get people through the ubiquitous part of resistance. And resistance really to change manifests itself in so many ways, everything from foot dragging and inertia to really petty sabotage and maybe even some outright rebellions, which many of us, of course, have had to contend with, unwrap from, and keep ourselves unwrapped from. That overarching hook, though, is what I'd like to be mindful of, is that, you know, people move if they really feel two things, either one, sufficient pain, or two, see sufficient opportunity. And as a leader, quite honestly, I would much rather take on that challenge of getting people to see the opportunity than necessarily contain an ongoing fear of the pain or dealing with the pain and paint a picture that makes them want to play forward as opposed to stay rooted in maybe something that's an exit and really think in terms of an entrance. Dr. Kanter's first point is that people resist change because of loss or control. And obviously this idea that it affects our autonomy, it can make people feel really lost and or over and outside of their own territory of comfort. And it's not just political when we say loss of control, you know, as in who's in power. It's really our sense of self-determination, what she spoke about. And so what I would say is that really smart leaders leave room for those affected by a change to make their own choices. Now, that can get pretty dicey. And they really, leaders invite others to be in the planning and give them a partial ownership in that process. And I tell a story of that was no more graphic at this point than what I stumbled into, because I kind of felt this is what I would want. We were involved in leading a major organizational change in a company and shifting it from the projects being very program management dominated to a blend of having program managers as well as then employees embedded in big home rooms, we'll call it, that were functional groups, for example, mechanical engineering, or a group dedicated to a certain product component that then these people would be matrixed over to programmatic teams. The type of leaders that lead those types of groups really are very different in skills. One is very focused more on the project execution and project skills, whereas the other is also vested with the responsibility of nurturing and training basic skills for people to perform on multiple programs. Those leaders are also responsible for sharing institutional wisdom across programs. They're so incentivized and recognized. So in many regards, the leaders and also the kind of people that gravitate to those two types of, albeit multifaceted roles, are kind of wear different suits and different clothes. Be that as it may, though, are moving to that type of an organization might have some perceived hierarchy either way. And I made the decision to kind of let all the employees post for these newly sculpted roles that we were introducing. And mind you, we're talking 400 people and for 400 roles, by the way. There was no intention that anyone would be eased out, although we knew some people probably wouldn't be up for the new challenges, and we'd do our best to help them out. Now, at the time, my boss and also my peers thought I was categorically insane to do something like this, to be able to manage the expectations around someone requesting a certain type of job, and then how would I let them down when they couldn't get it? And my response to them was, well, you folks are presupposing that we won't have people go across that entire random distribution and select and naturally fit towards these roles the way that we had sculpted it. Now, in truth, I was probably sitting in the back scratching my head, knowing I had a certain amount of risk out here. But I also felt, most importantly, that the fact I wanted people to take charge, take ownership, and feel in control of their own destiny was so important to not just getting in the right chairs, but the work we had to do once everybody got placed. The long and the short of it is that all but five people, indeed, requested their number one choice, and we were able to slot them into those roles. And of those five, I had very careful conversations to let them know that probably a career rotation within the next 2 to 3 years would allow them that chance to ease over into these other functions, and that we were committed to making that happen for them. The idea of giving the people the chance to indeed have an element of control amidst, by the way, countless other things we were doing at the same time really endeared a possibility, and that way they felt they had an opportunity to sculpt that new territory. So that was number one. Number two, of course, whenever leading change, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And Dr. Cantor says what really prompts resistance is when there is excess uncertainty. And I have no idea actually how you would measure that barometer. But really, you know, if it feels that change is driving you blindfolded, walking off a cliff, then people are going to reject it. And they're also going to prefer to remain mired even in misery than head toward the unknown. Because, you know, that saying, you know, better the devil you know than the devil you don't know. So even though it's a yucky situation, people will stick through it, not even knowing or thinking something's better. So to overcome that sense of inertia, to get to a place of safety, I'd say, you know, as well as to inspire a vision, that truly leaders have to create a certainty in the process of how we're going to go forward. So it's recognizing we're all on a journey, but there's going to be some simple steps, some timetables, and the more clear and exact you can make them, and maybe even have to change the change in the process, the more apt people can deal with uncertainty, and that which might feel excessive can actually be more bounded. So the real question then for those of us who are leaders is, how do you create some certainty and also do it frequently, do it early, and be prepared to change the change? It reminds me of a story that I got involved in when we realized, this is back in my car days, that one of our biggest challenges in introducing new products is that we were uncovering problems way too late in the process. And in particular, when we launched into these multi-billion, notice the B, billion-dollar factories, that trying to change the wheels on the race car while you're going around the track, in other words, bring design changes to the fore when you're trying to launch high-speed production, is not the smart thing to do. So maybe you could do it when you're in a slow build mode. Classically, when cars are built in prototypes, they're done in the engineering laboratory setting where there's a lot more measured pace. You take the parts out of boxes. You can hold your children that you designed. You can look at them on the interface. And we have, by the way, a cadre of very skilled technicians that basically could get anything to fit and give us feedback in the process. But one thing we didn't have the opportunity to see if you built a car that way would be the wisdom that comes from building them at speed or building them, albeit a slow speed, in a certain set of processes. So the organization I was leading at the time, we went forward with a proposal to actually build the prototype cars in a production facility, a production setting with the similar tools and, most importantly, with the men and women that would ultimately build the vehicle at 50 to 60 jobs an hour. Again, something that had never been done before, tremendous amount of uncertainty, but the fact that we stepped in and piloted this new concept and we held hands all along the way and we admitted we weren't going to get it all right out of the chute the first time, it let people kind of see and play with that vision in order to get that best possible startup when the new factory came about. The end upshot is we ended up rolling over 2,500 changes in those 85 prototype cars, which, by the way, was necessary for us to then go test and validate the vehicles. But most importantly, it built an esprit de corps amongst the entire team and crossed over into a part of the organization that formally that didn't happen until you really started moving towards production. So again, number one, how to give people a sense of control, not feel like they've been stripped of control. How to deal with uncertainty, excessive or not excessive, and give them a place in that so they can create some certainty and amongst the change. Number three, Dr. Kanner talks about, oh, a classic phase, surprise, surprise. In other words, decisions that are imposed on people suddenly with no time to get used to the idea, prepare for the consequences. Those usually and generally get resisted. It's our natural tendency. It's always easier to say no, and then if there's enough time to get to a yes. So really, her message is that leaders should avoid the temptation to craft changes that are in secret and announce them all at once. In other words, it's better to plant some seeds and then you sprinkle hints of what might be coming and seek input. I know there are a few leaders are out there listening to this and saying, yeah, that sounds nice, but if you leak too much, how do you know? Because you might find a slippery slope, or the confidentiality of what's involved may not allow you to do that. If there's legal barriers that are being crossed, if it's a merger, acquisition, impact on investors, on your other stakeholders. Be that as it may, you know, I have to say, I will have to admit that I have blown this one on a number of occasions. It isn't probably because I didn't plant the seeds, but I didn't realize that there were bigger winds out there or that actually the seeds hadn't even taken any roots. So it never dawned on me that this element of surprise could toss up backwards before we could go forward. And let me cite a personal example, although I think it's a metaphor that would work well in the working world, and that would be my husband's and my decision 8 years ago to move our family to Arizona. And our kids were 6 and 10 at the time. And we thought we'd planted all the seeds about, you know, taking some trips out west without calling it for what it was, talking about the idea of new schools and so on. But, you know, not until we announced to them that we were moving to Arizona did we realize suddenly how, you know, the big ball and chain that they could hook, they hooked really strong. So we kind of had to step back and recover and say, okay, what new seeds or what seeds could we have planted that we didn't? And let's continue now on that course correction. And one of them was indeed taking a family familiarization tour, I'll call it, to Arizona, and involving them in the house selection process, staying at a hotel that they could see when we drove around in the vicinity that, lo and behold, they have Macaroni Grill here in Tucson, just like they do back in Connecticut. I would say probably in hindsight, 8 years later, probably both of our kids still write in their creative writing classes about how their life was turned up in trauma because mom and dad surprised them, but the idea that they were then and we made a course correction as a family to step back. There's always going to be surprises when you lead change, and trying to embed then ways to get people to shift in their own way, through their own set of glasses, and through their own chair to get to the yes. Dr. Kanner mentions then that, you know, everything seems different when change is being embedded. That's right. It's meant to bring something different, by the way, but, you know, how different is different? And, you know, all of us are creatures of habit in some way. So our routines become automatic, but we change jolts us almost into this consciousness in very uncomfortable ways. And frankly, too many differences then can be distracting or confusing. And I'm sure she would advise on the flip, as I would, it isn't so much about minimizing the number of unrelated differences, not changes, unrelated differences that come up, but how can you give people a place to hook? And by the way, then how can you really, though, focus on the vital few and remain focused on those important things that, so that you don't change for the sake of change? I would have to say, though, and this is the provocative part of our show here, my conventional wisdom running in the face of, is I've often found when you're running a big change agenda, because of not so much resistance but that comfort zone, people really underestimate their capacity to change and their capacity to do multiple things at the same time, such that if you're really an astute leader and you see the possibility that as long as we're up there stirring things up, we could open three or four other doors to land further possibilities so that at the end of the change or when we take a breather, everyone's sort of overcome with shock that look what else we did and didn't realize it, that that was really important. And again, a story comes to mind that I had this large organization that we made the decision of moving half of the group, which was based in Florida at the time, up to Connecticut. And the whole goal, of course, and the opportunity by co-locating these groups, we could do that much better of a job of the technical execution of both our commercial and our military programs. The upside as well is prior to this, this particular department, very large, had been probably bereft with lower morale than other parts of the organization. They were had not been the benefit of investment in tools and practices and all the things us engineers love, so we can do an even finer and better job. And we're under constant stress and distress of being last in the poll and having to recover from a lot of mistakes. By moving this group north at the same time, we indeed were able to shift attitudes and build an even stronger family and an esprit de corps amongst these employees, particularly the incumbents on both sides of the fence, to realize that we had a lot greater capability than we'd ever known to capitalize on. So in some regards, the adversity, I'll say it, the internal company adversity that this group was dealing with, suddenly got flipped on its ear as the team felt a collective power to work together. Was everything seeming different at that time? You bet it was. But the cause and the reason for making it go to a different place was something everyone really could embody. Number five that I'd like to speak with and wrap up here for this first part of my conversation, though, this really plays out when leading change, is there's a loss of face. In other words, by definition, change is a departure from the past. And those people who were associated with the past version, even if at one time had been successful, in some way feel that, gee, now they've been pegged for it no longer working, or that they feel they're the ones being superseded and they could be really defensive about making any shift. Of course, there's pride and heritage in what they did, and so it should be recognized. So when the change involves a big shift of strategic direction, really the people responsible for the previous direction dread the perception that they must have been wrong, that they did something incomplete, they weren't good enough. So as leaders, the idea is really recognizing that many of these changes that we're bringing to our organization is on the heels of a strong history, but it's also usually to go after an exciting future. And that goes back to my comment about how to get people to embrace changes. One thing is to realize the opportunity of a better future. But at the same time, realize that, yes, we're going to change institutions and processes and things that were set up the way they've always been. And by the way, that affects an awful lot of the leaders at the same time. In fact, that's the story I would quickly talk about, is that I was brought in from the outside in a major company that was global. They had 25 different engineering centers around the world to engineer products for regional application. But quite honestly, we were underestimating the opportunity then to share best practices and ideas, let alone load our factories so that they could deal with maybe local differences but produce for world markets. And what happened was, is under the guidance of the man I reported to, the team of 26 executives or so made the decision that we would leave our titles at the door, leave our geographies at the door even, and participate as a cohesive team to determine what was the right number of centers of expertise around the world to do the engineering for these major products. So in this case, it wasn't just the history of those who were working for us that were going to be affected by this change, as we indeed did make the decision to close a couple centers, converge others, shift entire disciplines from one part of the world to another part of the world, but it affected the leaders. And for all of you who are involved in leading change, know that really it's your responsibility to adopt a new face in amongst that which you're going to ask your people to change. So the loss of face, the adopting of new face, is something that we all collectively can do, and also recognize that that past and that legacy and that know-how is something that none of us could move forward without, and how do we frame it? So with that, the first five I'd like to close with today again were, how do you turn loss of control into feeling in control by people feeling like they have an answer in that? Go from excess uncertainty to creatively tapping into that uncertainty and piloting possibilities. Yes, surprise, surprise, but how do you get people to yes is probably plant some seeds so that the surprise doesn't come quite from left field. Know that indeed, number four, everything seems different, but what similar things and sameness can you capitalize so you can remain focused on the important things? And then finally, loss of face, shift that to give face to the uncertainty for others to care.
Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it.